Okay. The NLRB versus Teamsters 662.
Please say.
Ms. Hartley.
May it please the court. My name is Jill Hartley, and I represent the respondent in this matter, General Teamsters Union Local Number 662. This case is before you today on the National Labor Relations Board's petition for enforcement of its July 31, 2003 decision and order affirming Administrative Law Judge William Pannier's decision finding that the union, Local 662, committed an unfair labor practice in violation of Section 8B3 of the National Labor Relations Act by refusing to execute a collective bargaining agreement embodying agreement reached on October 4th, 2000, with respect to the terms and conditions of the employment of the bargaining unit at the W.S. Darley Company in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
I want to just ask you right off the bat, the record will tell us that the media was there, right?
Yes.
What was the media? Will the record tell us what the media was told by the two parties?
The transcript, which is in the appendix, does contain some testimony about what the parties said to the media. There was also a videotape that was entered into evidence at the trial in this matter. That is some portion of the news coverage.
So did the parties come out and say, hooray, we have an agreement?
The parties came out and told the news media that they had reached a tentative agreement and also informed the media that it would be subject to ratification or be presented to a ratification vote to the members of the bargaining unit.
I'd like to ask you what you think the outcome of this case would be if the employer were the one asserting that the contract was unenforceable because there were problems with ratification. Would the employer be able to assert as a defense that the agreement was not properly ratified?
No.
No. Only you.
There is established National Labor Relations Board case law that indicates that employers are not allowed to question the union's internal ratification procedures. And there are a number of cases that address that issue and don't allow employers to question that.
Doesn't seem quite fair, does it?
Well, I think the union is in somewhat of a different position than the employer. It's the union who creates its own internal ratification procedures based on the fact that it has to represent the members who are going to live under this collective bargaining agreement. And the union is controlled by the desires and the wishes of the membership. So ratification, because it is a purely internal union procedure, takes on a different role in the case where the union is addressing problems with a ratification.
And would I be just totally off base if I believed that the union behaved as though the parties had a deal to execute and the only deal on the table was the full agreement, including the two disputed items, and that if the union thought its membership had rejected that deal, that it should have returned to the bargaining table, not ended the strike? Would I just be
You're correct. If the bargaining unit would have rejected the entire tentative agreement, then there would be no contract. The parties would have to return to the the bargaining table, and presumably the strike would have continued because there was never any agreement that the members would return without a contract.
But wasn't the only deal on the table the full agreement, including the two disputed items?
At the conclusion of the negotiation session on October 3rd that went into the early morning hours of the 4th, the parties had reached a tentative agreement on all items, including the steward waiver provisions that are the heart of this matter. But it was a tentative agreement which the union made clear to the company was subject to ratification by the membership.
Well, okay.
That obviously didn't happen. The membership did not vote on those two disputed items, miscellaneous items 3 and 4. And that is because prior to the start of the ratification meeting, at least two of the individuals who were affected, two of the stewards, came to the union and said they had second thoughts, essentially, about waiving their right to hold bargaining unit steward positions and committee positions in the future for the rest of their employment with the company. The testimony at trial indicated that one individual in particular informed the union he had actually contacted the regional office of the National Labor Relations Board and been advised on filing charges possibly against the union, and told that the union should be careful presenting this proposal to the membership for ratification. Based on that individual and when he spoke, another one of the stewards who was also affected spoke up and indicated that he was having second thoughts also. They said they weren't going to agree to it. It was no longer going to be a voluntary agreement to waive their right to serve as stewards and serve on the bargaining committee. The union had informed the company during the negotiation session when this issue was addressed that it would only agree to that provision if the affected individuals voluntarily agreed. Although they did, at the time that the parties were meeting on October 3rd and 4th, they later changed their minds, and it was that change of those two individuals' minds that prompted the union to consult with counsel and ultimately determine that they would not put those provisions forward to the bargaining unit for ratification.
Ms. Hartley, do you want to speak to the waiver argument that's been presented here on Provision 3, whether it was preserved before the ALJ?
Certainly. The waiver argument, and I'm assuming you're referring to the illegal, whether the waiver was an illegal subject of bargaining. The illegality of the provision was not specifically briefed to the administrative law judge. We do not dispute that. It was raised in the exceptions before the National Labor Relations Board. And it is our position that that was proper based on the fact that whether a provision or a proposal is a permissive or an illegal or a mandatory subject to bargaining is a question of law, and that was proper pursuant to board regulations to raise in front of the board, although it had not been specifically addressed with the administrative law judge.
Well, but the ALJ considered whether the provision violated public policy, because at the bottom of page 8 of the ALJ's order, he said that item 3, which is the form member waiver provision, was a permissive subject of bargaining. So how is it waived? How was it waived? I mean, the ALJ actually notes that.
Yes, that's true. The ALJ determined that it was a permissive subject of bargaining. The union took the position in front of the National Labor Relations Board when it filed exceptions to the judge's decision that it was not, in fact, a permissive subject of bargaining, but it was an illegal subject of bargaining. Based on the fact that this was a conclusion of law that the ALJ made, is the union's position that it was proper to raise before the NLRB at that time for the first time in the exception. And also the fact that the legality or the illegality, of the provision was certainly addressed at negotiations and also at the trial before the administrative law judge.
Okay. At the conclusion of the, whatever the ratification vote, the four striking members who were reinstated, had the seniority according with the agreement, would, given the fact that this other part was not ratified, the reneging of the at least two of the four, would it have been proper under this, would it have been an unfair labor practice for the company not to reinstate those four?
So you're saying if there
in other words, those they're saying you know, they cut a part of the agreement out, and so it would have been okay for the company not to reinstate the four people.
Well, you know, I'm sure the union may have filed an unfair labor practice charge over that. Since it didn't occur, I'm...
No, they put them back to work.
Exactly.
According with what they considered the agreement.
They did, yeah.
And that's sort of what the ALJ is saying. Look, they complied with what was supposed to be the agreement.
That's true, that they did comply with what they believed that the agreement was, but... At all times during the negotiations, the union informed the company that this was a tentative agreement that was subject to ratification by the membership.
Well, when did they inform them that the ratification did not include the people who were supposedly not going to participate further?
There's some dispute in the record about that, but essentially what the administrative law judge has determined is that the conversation that took place between the union business agent and the company's chief negotiator occurred the afternoon, I believe, of October 9th, which would have been the Monday following their final negotiation session and the ratification vote, and also the afternoon of the day that the striking employees returned to work.
Right. After they put the other people back to work, they said, incidentally, these guys aren't agreeing to stay off the next negotiating committee.
Well, that's true, although there had been attempts to contact the company's chief negotiator prior to that to let him know that. It just happened, so happened that
he was... And if he'd gotten a hold of them on Friday and they didn't send those four back to work, that would have been a problem, probably.
Well, at that point, I guess it depends on how the parties resolve the issue of the contract. If the company would have told the union, well, then we don't have a collective bargaining agreement, then presumably the union would have said we need to return to the table and the employees would still be on strike. That's certainly a possibility as to what would have happened in that situation.
It might have gotten the attention of the two people that were, some could say selfishly, extracting themselves from the previous agreement. Might have said, guess what? You got to sign this, because those, and I'm sure that would have been solved probably on Saturday.
That's certainly a possibility.
Ms. Harris, before you sit down and reserve the rest of your time, which I assume is what you intended to do,
yes.
I just want to make sure I understand your response to Judge Rovner on this question of what the ALJ considered. Is it correct to assume that he discussed the permissive subject of bargaining, but he did not discuss whether Provision 3 would constitute an illegal subject of bargaining?
That's correct.
So it isn't absolutely clear that, so you did not mention, seek to preserve that before, and that wasn't discussed before. So.
The union did not argue for the administrative law judge that it was an illegal subject. No, you're correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Deenan?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Wosha Deenan. I represent the board which seeks enforcement of its order in this case. In this case, the union simply reneged on its agreement and is now attempting to assert that it's deliberately created deficiencies in its contract ratification process excuses that misconduct. It's undisputed that the parties agreed to a quid pro quo in which four employee members of the union negotiating committee would resign from their union posts, and in return, the company would reinstate four additional strikers that it didn't even need. The parties' conduct demonstrated that agreement had been reached. They concluded negotiations. They shook hands. They stated that they had reached an agreement. They informed the media, and the union ended its strike. However, at the last minute, the union unilaterally cut out the quid pro quo when presenting the contract to its members. And its main defense now is that ratification was incomplete somehow. This court in Roll and Hold and the board in a number of cases has held that in order to create a condition precedent, the parties must specifically reach a mutual agreement to make it so. The court and the board have held that merely informing the other side that an agreement is subject to ratification is simply insufficient to create that condition. And in this case, the union has cited no evidence that the company agreed to such a condition. And in any event, once the union provides notice that ratification has occurred, the board will not go behind that notice. And typically, these cases arise with employers asserting deficiencies in ratification. But there's at least one case, the Teamsters 251 case, in which the board has refused to allow a union to assert deficiencies in the ratification process to excuse its refusal to execute. Further, any deficiencies in the ratification process were the result of the union's deliberate choice not to submit the entire agreement to employees for ratification. And as a policy matter, it would create bad labor policy to allow a party unilaterally carve out a provision, and this would simply destabilize the collective bargaining process. And with respect to this procedural issue about the illegality argument, before the ALJ, well, let me back up. There's three categories for subjects of bargaining: mandatory, permissive, and illegal. Before the ALJ, the union argued that it was permissive, and the ALJ so found. However, before the board, the union changed its mind and said it was an illegal provision. And naturally, the board refused to consider that argument as it was not raised to the ALJ. And furthermore, in its opening brief to this court, the union failed to contest that the board's procedural finding. So for, on two different levels, the union's illegality argument is barred before the court. And furthermore, substantively, it simply failed. The selection of a union's representative is a permissive subject of bargaining. The union was right the first time when it argued that to the ALJ. The union's only cases that it cites on this issue involve companies that insist on particular representatives or refuse to bargain with particular representatives. In this case, the company didn't do that. It simply proposed this quid pro quo, and the union accepted it. And at the point where two of the members tried to back out of it, it was just too late. They had already reached agreement. And I'd also like to point out that to the extent that the union is arguing that it raised this issue at the bargaining table and at trial, the record shows that the union did raise concerns about the quid pro quo provision when it was proposed, but they agreed to it anyway. And it was simply too late for them to back out of it when it tried to do so. The court has no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Harley?
I'd like to address the board's position that the union deliberately created this deficiency in the ratification procedure. It's true that the union decided it was not going to submit these two disputed provisions to the bargaining unit for ratification. However, that was done specifically in response to, as I indicated earlier, these two bargaining committee members who came to the union and said, we're not going to sign off on this, we're not going to agree to it. It is also the union's position that the requirement, in addition to simply agreeing to waive their steward positions, the company's proposal to the union also required that each of these four individuals sign an individual waiver confirming that they would no longer hold the committee position and would agree not to run for the position again in the future during the rest of the term of their employment with the company. It's the union's position that that requirement of signing an individual waiver also created a condition precedent that had to be fulfilled before a final and binding contract could be reached. And that didn't happen here. None of the four stewards who were on the committee at that time ever signed a waiver agreeing not to act as committee members or not to act as stewards then or in the future. And without that waiver, the union couldn't perform, couldn't execute the contract, requiring the committee members to do so. The board's position that the ratification was not a condition precedent, we also obviously disagree with that. There is no board precedent that requires that an agreement, that ratification be accomplished before an agreement is final and binding, be in writing. And I see that my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Ms. Newman. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will